This episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where each month we have the chance to sit down with someone interesting from Northern Ireland who's living and working overseas. To find out more about our global diaspora, listen to previous episodes in the series and sign up for a free monthly newsletter, please visit niconnections.com. Thanks so much, and really hope you enjoy today's conversation.
Actually, one of my first memories was I remember myself and my sister were in two cots in the bedroom, and she was almost 2 years older than me, and I remember she could climb out of her cot and I couldn't get out of mine. And I don't know if that was kind of setting me up for what was to come later in life.
Bro, but that's like the deep, like Freudian, like origin story. And from that moment, I knew I wanted to climb.
You know, it's funny because I often think I don't really remember a lot then for, you know, a couple of years after that. But that's one memory that's very firm in my mind.
And that's so funny.
Wonder is it real, or you know, is it just something you kind of imagined? But I just remember being in awe of her and how she could manage to get her legs up over the cot and get out.
Super cool.
Yeah,
we've been doing a sports series recently on the show, and actually, like a common thing that keeps popping up is like older siblings, and there is that kind of like competitive nature to like us as humans. It's just like, oh, here they can do that, I want to be able to do that too. Do you know what I mean?
Totally. Especially when you're very young, things that just seem so very impossible to you. You think your older siblings are just amazing.
Yeah, they're like the gods that walk the earth. Where were you born and bred?
So I was born, I grew up on a farm just outside the very beautiful village of Gorchan in County Tyrone. I don't know if you know Gorchan. But it's a great little village at the foothills of the Sperrin Mountains.
Mm.
And so I grew up on the farm, and I have three older siblings and my parents. And
class.
I just loved the farm. I loved everything about it. And I loved just being outside and getting involved in all the work. And it was very much, I think it was a great way to grow up, because you feel as if you're a very important person, and you know you're involved in everything in the farm, from lambing season to everything. And it's just, you know, you see all the cycle of nature and life, and I think that's something, you know, when I was very young, I kind of knew exactly who I was and what I loved doing, and it was always being outside. So I think that's why I loved climbing when I eventually did find it. It was the exact same kind of connection with nature that I really missed after I left, you know, the farm, and I went to university and moved to the city.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. What was your chore? Like, what was there kind of like an area or like a department that kept kind of falling on your lap?
Well, do you know what? It was kind of funny because there was four of us, two older brothers and an older sister. So I suppose the way the work was kind of designated was the boys would, you know, do the work on the farm, and myself and my sister would, you know, help my mom. And quite often, like, that would be like cooking for a lot of people who'd be working on the farm. But I didn't really have much interest in the indoor chores. So I always just remember trying to get everything finished up really quickly and getting outside. And, you know, I'd always be asking my brothers, what can I do? What can I do?
I love that.
So it was great. You know, it was such an amazing childhood looking back.
Was there a favorite animal in there?
Well, you know, we had a lot of sheepdogs on the farm, and my dad used to compete in sheepdog trials. So that was kind of a really important thing for us growing up as kids. And I think anyone who's grown up with dogs, you know, they're the most amazing animals. So we would have spent a lot of time even just out having our own dogs and training our own dogs. And of course, you'd always have, you know, pet lambs in the spring that you'd be trying not to get too attached to, because you know that they're probably not going to be around forever, unfortunately. But yeah, it was great. There was, you know, jobs you loved, and then jobs you kind of you didn't really like. But sure. Looking back, it's such fun memories, like going to the start of the summer holidays. We'd all be heading out to the bog to turn turf, and it was a job that was one of those jobs was if you looked ahead at how much you had to do, you wouldn't really you'd want to just go home again.
Sure.
And so I remember being taught to like always look behind and, you know, say, oh, look how much I've done, that's a great job. But it was, you know, as kids, it was so much fun just being out in the mountainside. And, you know, I'd say we weren't doing an awful lot of work. Sure. I'd say a lot of the times we're probably more of a hindrance to our parents than anything. But it was, yeah, just all really good memories, I think. And yeah, I could go on all day.
That's like such a beautiful, like, visual image that you've shared about like looking behind you and seeing how far you've come rather than to see how far like you have to go. Like you mentioned your dad there, and that wee kind of story there kind of triggered one of the things he sent through. Like one of your favorite quotes was from your dad, and you'd said it was like, stick at it, you're always gaining. Well, like what's that all about? Like why was that something that was really important for him?
Well, I think maybe, you know, at the time when he was saying it, maybe it wasn't that important, but it was just something, I guess, for any job that you were doing outside or anything, or even having difficulties. I remember when I was in university, you know, that was something he said, and it's something that I've definitely it's taken with me in the ice climbing and especially the training. And I guess later in life, my father was very sick for a long time before he died. And I just remember he had Parkinson's disease. And so it was a degenerative disease. And he was always a very hard worker on the farm. And, you know, he'd be always up at the crack of dawn and out, you know, minding the animals. And as his health regressed, he never gave up, and he just kept doing small jobs and smaller jobs and smaller jobs. And I, you know, even brushing the floor in the kitchen, I remember watching him one day, and it took him such a long time, but, you know, that was his project for the day. And
yeah.
I just thought it was amazing to see that, and just to see, you know, we don't know what's ahead of us in life, and it was his way of coping with things and his way of, you know, making every day count.
Yeah.
And that was something I think maybe just then really, really stuck with me. And especially with ice climbing training, it's sometimes it feels really, you feel as if you're making no progress. And especially when you start at the beginning of the season again, you know, after taking a break, it seems like such a mountain to climb to get back to your condition before.
You're like cursing your hands. You're like, why have you become so weak?
Do you know what? It's so true. And there is that point, and you're just like, you do want to kind of just maybe think, oh, maybe I can't do it this year, or I can't get back to that. But you are always gaining. And with climbing in particular, it's a sort of sport that you have. I don't know if you've ever tried climbing, Matt.
So I have done climbing, never in cold conditions. It's always been in the likes of like Boulder and gyms and like high ropes and all that sort of stuff.
Okay. So you'll understand about climbing. Normally when you start a project or a route, it can seem really impossible in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you try it again and you go back a week later and suddenly you can do it. And that's just the way climbing is, that it's a constant series of projects, and you always feel a bit of an achievement whenever you complete something and then you just move on to something else. So
absolutely. And I think it's so fascinating, like what you shared about your dad, and You know, I think like I'll just betray myself here. Like I'm a millennial, like and I think like something that my generation gets kind of the finger pointed at for is like this idea of like shying away from hard work. And, you know, I can hold my hands up and say like there's been plenty of times where like guilty is charged. It's like part of my own journey is realizing that actually like there is so much reward and satisfaction in like the hard work itself. Not even like the reward or not even like where it takes you, but like the actual process itself of doing something hard, like doing the project is actually very rewarding. And there's like something to do with like humans that like we kind of need that. And it's like by trying to like go after easy things or not pushing ourselves, like especially physically, you can kind of end up like missing part of your life or like having like a bit of a lack.
Oh, for sure. I totally agree with that. I think, you know, I suppose I grew up on a farm, so I just presumed that's the way everyone, you know, grew up and everyone lived. And, you know, you woke up in the morning and you had a series of things to do. And, you know, and it comes to lambing season and you go out really early and you check the sheep. And if you're not there on time, you know, maybe something will happen and a lamb will die. And you feel it gives you a real sense of importance. And I think that's a lot of people, you know, maybe just don't have that. Just there's the circumstances they grow up in, you know, maybe they don't have the chance to get involved in certain clubs or sports. So it's something I feel very lucky to have experienced that. And I think that's why sports are really important for the younger generation growing up, that sports and community, that you feel that you're a part of something and that you're doing something worthwhile. I think we all need to think we're doing something worthwhile. And with projects and that, it's so true. Sometimes when you finish a project, there's just, there is no real joy at the end.
Yes.
It's kind of, you've put so much into it that like at the end there's a kind of an emptiness and you sort of miss it until you start something new. And I think it's, you know, it's in every walk of life. If you ever put in 100% into something, that the rewards are the journey for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then like you said, there's it's almost like an itch, like the itch comes back where you're kind of like, okay, right, what's next? You know, what's the next thing that we're going to do here? So
That's so true.
Like little elements of like competitiveness there with the sheepdogs, like talk to me about like competition in like your family culture. Like, were you really into sports? Like, did you like do every sport imaginable in school? Were you not into that? Like, tell me a little bit about that.
As grown up as kids in the farm, like I guess you're so involved in the farm that is kind of, you know,
that's the sport.
It's sort of, in a way, like, you know, later in my teenage years, there was a ladies football team started in the local village. But before that, it was, you know, there'd be no such thing as going for a jog in the morning, like, because you'd be like, why would you be wasting your energy around
what
the road?
A waste,
you
can the calories.
Jog down there and get some spuds from the field. I mean, that was, you know, that was just a time when it was, you were just so active. So in school, like, I just did the regular sports that everyone does. And I wouldn't say I was extremely sporty at all. I was always known to be very strong. Just back in the farm, I was kind of built quite sturdily as a kid. And I was kind of good at lifting heavy things.
Are you stronger upper body or lower body? Or is it that more like deadlift mechanism that you really like show your strength, your prowess?
Well, I don't know. When I was younger, I was... they kind of nicknamed me the bulldozer at home.
Love it.
So, I think it was just like I was a very solid mass.
Just and, a unit.
Very determined, yeah. I didn't have the physique for climbing for sure when I started the sport. And that's probably, you know, why I never even considered it for so long. I just thought, well, I don't have any upper body strength. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be any good at that sport. And I think that's something you're just maybe a little bit conditioned growing up. You're either good at a sport or you're not good at a sport, like yeah. sometimes. And you're very quickly, you put yourself in a box and say, well, this is where I'm at. And I went to UCD and studied there, and I remember looking at the climbing wall numerous times thinking, oh, that looks like a great activity, but oh, I wish I had the body, you know, to do that.
So
but
interesting. Wow.
You know, I never even stepped foot into it. I kind of looked at it from the walking by, but yeah, I completely just ruled it out. And I think, yeah, I think that happens a lot of, you know, people, kids growing up, and you just maybe have a certain perception of yourself.
Yeah.
And it was then, as maybe as you get older, you can start to break that down a wee bit and mm-hmm. and try new things and give it a go. So
totally. And I mean, there is that huge misconception that I have paid for physically with pain many times on the climbing wall, where you think as a novice that it's all upper body, and then, you know, all the experienced climbers are kind of like laughing at you because they're like, bro, it's pretty much all legs.
It's like, so true.
Can you just complete, yeah. like, you know, I have mates like shouting up at me like, use your flipping legs, and I'm like, I don't know how to, like, you know. And any
just
like
stand up,
yeah, literally any sort of like improvement I saw, you know, on the bouldering wall is like learning to get my legs in the right position and learning to actually use them instead of just trying to do pull-ups for like 10 minutes. Do you know what I mean?
It's so true. And I think like that is the thing. Like climbing is a sport where I think women can get to the same level as men. And quite often, depending on the routes, women can climb harder than men. And,
unreal.
You know, it's all very dependent on the rock style. And in the beginning, women do have an advantage because, you know, we generally just don't have any upper body strength, like, and so we do have to use our legs from the beginning. So I think our technique generally improves a lot faster than I think guys with a lot of muscle can they can suffer from, you know, not learning the proper technique and that.
Yeah,
so
yeah
it's yeah perseverance, I think. And it's yeah, I think climbing is it's not what I expected to be for sure. When you get to the higher grades in climbing, there is like a certain amount of body conditioning and training you have to do, but it's much more of a kind of artistic form than people maybe would imagine sometimes. That you're, especially with rock climbing, you're trying to work out this puzzle, and sometimes can just be kind of feel like almost like a dance that you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
it's almost like, and again, like, I'm a complete outsider, so I'm literally spoofing here, but like, it seems like more so than even other sports, like the most important muscle, quote unquote, is like the brain, you know, like the way I see climbers step back and like analyze like what path they're going to take. It's like watching Einstein trying to like crack a new theory. You're like, oh my goodness, like they're seriously thinking about this. Do you know what I mean? Whereas I'm like looking at it, I'm like, okay, let's go.
You know, it is like I definitely think the mental side of the sport is so important, because especially with climbing, normally you're going to like make a breakthrough on a route or finish it when you really get to the point where you feel I can't hold on any longer. Like your mind is, everything is telling you no. But you just have to be able to like to push on. And, you know, there's a lot of things, the fear of being at a height mm-hmm. as well, the fear of falling, it's all very real. And although it's, you know, it's you're climbing with ropes, it's completely safe. And a lot of the time when you're tired, the fear just gets stronger and stronger. And the strongest climbers are the ones who are able to like just have a lot of self-belief and just keep telling themselves whenever that happens that, yeah, I can get through this, I can do it. And the mental aspect of it is something that I really struggle with a lot. I kind of I would do a lot of training and training and training in the gym. And then, you know, sometimes I go out to the wall and you just don't have the belief in yourself. Mm. And I think that's an important thing. I guess it's an important thing in anything in life, but yeah. And I guess the whole idea of working out a puzzle and, as you say, like standing back and trying to work out how things go. And sometimes they don't actually, they don't work out the way you think the moves are. And I think that's when it's really important to be able to say, oh, well, that didn't work, but I'll have to try this.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, being like, oh, that didn't work. Well, that's, you know, I'll try it again next time.
Yeah. Time to fall.
Yeah.
I'm really fascinated what you said of how, like, it's almost like the moment where you feel like giving up is usually the moment where you're very close to solving it. Like, I don't know, this is like really like esoteric or like philosophical, but like, what do you think like the importance of like desperation, or what role does like desperation play in almost like giving you the ability to do things that you didn't think was possible?
Yeah, you know, it's the thing about it is the climbers who climb the best are the ones that they just can keep their mind quiet. And there are different techniques that you can use when you're climbing, like always giving like positive talk. So when you come to a point that you're always kind of saying that you like it's positive, instead of saying, oh, this hole's not good, or, you know, oh, I don't know what's next. Because your mind is constantly chattering away. So you have to kind of tell yourself like positive things, like, oh, I'm strong. Oh, my arms aren't pumped. Oh, this is, you know, there's going to be a good hold up here.
Nice.
And you're almost fooling yourself in a way. And I kind of do find that hard. I've been, you know, studying a bit and listening to some podcasts about how to deal with fear and how to give kind of positive, to kind of visualize the route first and then visualize yourself successfully climbing it. Mm. Apparently is a really important thing, and see yourself getting to the top of it, and then being able to just, you know, once you get any doubt or fear, you know yourself with climbing, your arms just get so pumped. And when your arms get pumped, you know, you don't have that much more time left before you fall off. So yeah, I think the desperation part of it, I know with the competition climbing, quite often the difference, maybe getting into a final or the difference in getting in the podium, is literally touching the next hold.
Wow.
So you always have to, even
brutal. Wow.
Even when you're like, you know, you're falling, you have to try and just get like something more. So it always comes down, because everybody's trained the same way. And I think when it comes to that stage, if everybody was to climb like say a final route for the second time, like most of the finalists would get to the top, but it's just, you know, that ability to do it on site.
Yeah.
And just, yeah. So there are a few climbers, you know, in the competition circuit, and they're just amazing for that ability, just to always be able to have that drive. And it's, yeah, my climbing coach here, you know, he said way back to me that the climbing only starts when your arms are so pumped that you won't fall off.
What a great,
you know, so it's like, that puts it all in a different perspective.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. That's like, I don't know who it was. I'm just going to like misattribute it to like big Arnold Schwarzenegger, like where it's like he said something like, you know, you're only starting to work out whenever it's like the last two reps of each set. And I'm like, oh, mate, that is the most brutal thing I've ever heard in my life. Flip's sake. I'm curious, like,
we're
a wee bit cart before the horse here, but I'm loving it. So I'm just going to stay here. Like, what are some things that you have maybe like learned on the wall or on the cliff that you now have in your toolkit for your everyday life, you know, for your 9-to-5 job or for your personal life or for, you know, just when you're not climbing? You know, have you learned any kind of like techniques or broader principles that have kind of really served you off the wall?
Well, trying to think of anything specific, I just think climbing in general has just given me a better appreciation for things. And I think that depending on the situation, if, you know, if you're out on a natural ice climb and it's extremely cold and it's maybe you've been out there for maybe 20 hours and it's getting dark and you have a lot of, you've kind of pushed yourself to the limit and it kind of, other things in life that you've been worried about, it kind of helps put things in perspective, I think. And sometimes that then you can go back to your normal life and you're like, well, that's, you know, that's not such a big deal.
I'm not going to fall off an ice cliff right now. It's not that big a deal.
I don't know.
My life is not in danger.
I don't know if that's a really good positive way to look at it, but I think just it's maybe made me have more belief in my own ability, and it doesn't always work out that way. I think maybe in living in Korea as well, as I think I'm definitely a very different person than before I came here.
Let's go there. Mm-hmm. Like, what were the seeds that made you even consider moving to Korea? Like, was that ever on your radar? Because, you know, on paper, growing up on a farm in Tyrone, it's not necessarily the logical leap. Do you know what I mean? And a lot of people from here are very proudly homebirds, and that's amazing, and all power to them. But how did you, why did you leave? Let's just say it that way.
So, yeah, it was never on my radar. And, you know, I often think if someone had it told, you know, my 25-year-old self that 10 years time you're going to be living in South Korea climbing frozen waterfalls, I would have freaked out. I would have just, you know, I wouldn't have been very happy over that prospect. And I had been living in Dublin for about 10 years and I went to university there and I studied architecture and was working for a good company in Dublin at the time, and I was approaching 30, so I had always wanted to go and do the work on holiday visa in Australia, so it was kind of my last chance. And so I thought long and hard about it. And
does it have a 30-year-old cap on it? Does it?
It does, yeah.
Interesting, didn't know that.
Yeah, so, well, it did back then. I'm not sure if it's different now, but so a lot of people had gone there you know, after university, but I had just started working and had been working for a few years. So I went to Australia, and, you know, before I left, things were booming in Ireland, and I came back and there were no jobs. Mm. And, you know, a lot of friends had lost their jobs. And I guess with the economy just kind of coming to a standstill, there was definitely no building happening. So architects were maybe one of the first to kind of suffer. And
100%.
At that time, a lot of people were going, you know, to Canada or Australia. It was really popular. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, I could go back to Australia. And, but I thought, no, because people go to Australia and they never come home.
Like,
so I'm not going there.
I'm going to go somewhere reasonable, like Korea.
Yeah. Well, you know, Korea is actually somewhere that was, it was always kind of in our life growing up, because my uncle was a missionary priest here back in the 70s. So there was always pictures of Korea, I remember, in our living room.
Yeah.
And so there was a connection. I didn't really know much about it, like, other than the fact that he had been here, and, you know, just some pieces of art at home.
What was Korea like in the 70s? That must have been interesting.
It was, yeah, like, it was a very different country.
Yeah.
It was a lot poorer then. I guess it was, you know, recovering from the Korean War. And, like, there's definitely a lot of similarities. I think we often talk about, you know, the culture and mm-hmm. Korea's, yeah, it developed so quickly in the last maybe 30 years. So yeah, at that time, yeah, he said there was, you know, there was a lot of people still really hungry in Korea.
Yeah.
There was maybe a more divide of wealth here. So yeah, he, you know, it was somewhere that I kind of known a little bit about. And so I had come back from Australia and I applied for jobs, lots of jobs, you know, all over Northern Ireland, in Dublin, and, you know, jobs Scotland and England. But I just, you know, I hadn't heard anything back. And I started looking into doing something, you know, in the meantime. And I did a TEFL course, teaching English as a foreign language. Awesome. And at that time I thought, you know, maybe I'll go to China or whatever. And I remember just very clearly, he came to visit us one day and I was outside and, you know, he was saying, what are you going to do, Emer? That was what everybody was asking me then. Cause you know, I'd been home, God, it was like 6 or 9 months then. And, there was nothing really happening. And,
the looming, you know, pressure of raised eyebrows starts to really haunt your dreams.
I suppose, yeah. And, you know, a lot of people are thinking, well, you left a very good job to go to Australia. You shouldn't have really done that now. But, yeah, so I'd say to him that I've been thinking about going abroad. And he immediately said, you have to go to Korea. And you love Korea. And he was so excited about it there and then. He said, it's just go for a year and experience it. And I remember going in, sitting at the kitchen with my mother, and, you know, he convinced her that Korea was such a safe place and a really great country to go. And he would have no worries about me going there. So that kind of decided it for me, I think, there and then, that, you know, I go and try it for a year. And so I started applying for jobs, and I got my first job here was in a big all girls high school.
Wow.
In one of the satellite cities of Seoul. So I moved here in November, and I remember, yeah, it was a bit of a culture shock for sure. That was like way before I'd even considered climbing. And I was living in an area there didn't seem to be any other foreigners. And it was a couple of hard months, you know. Absolutely. With Christmas in the right in the middle of it.
Yeah. And the loneliness is brutal in an environment like that, I think.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of you, just not even having someone to talk to can be pretty hard. You've lived abroad yourself, Matt, so you know exactly the kind of the loneliness.
Totally.
Yeah. So yeah, it was a few hard months, but I you know, I kind of was trying to be realistic about it and saying, well, you know, you can go home and it's going to be the same situation, or you can just kind of suck it up and just try and make this work. And then, you know, I was kind of fascinated by Korea as well at the same time. I couldn't really speak any Korean, but I was starting to get out and about a bit more in the spring. And then I was looking for, you know, groups to join, how to meet people. And I just came across this, it was a beginner multi-pitch rock climbing course for expats. And so I thought, oh, that sounds like fun.
That's me.
Yeah, you know, and like at the time it was like, oh, that's rock climbing. You know, maybe, I don't know, but it's for expats. So it was one of the first courses that jumped out. So I was kind of lucky for that company's marketing, you know, that it was what came up when I Googled. And then, so I joined that, and the very first week I met a good friend of mine who's from Mayo, Louise Cleary, and it was just amazing to meet someone from home in the very same course. And my whole life just kind of changed then, and Korea just overnight became the best place to be, because I started going climbing, and Louise had been there for some time, and she had already kind of integrated into the climbing community there, and there seemed to be a lot of other foreigners who were interested in the sport. And then I just, we'd go out every weekend. We'd be on some adventure in some corner of Korea. And yeah, that was the start of it, I guess. Sorry, that was a bit long-winded.
That's perfect. That's what this show's all about. It's just a long-winded show. And I think it's really fascinating. Like, I remember you saying at the start how, like, you know, you're really passionate about young people getting involved in sport, even for the community aspect. And I think, like, you know, I mean, it's amazing that you've gone on to literally, like, pick up six, like, World Cup medals in this sport. So that aside, but, like, even just to have, like, something to hang your hat on, as in like an excuse to meet other people and an excuse, like you said, to be with other people and explore with other people. Like, it sounds like it really was like the key that just unlocked your whole Korean experience, which is so subtle but so beautiful as well. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. And I think, you know, if I, in a lot of ways, if I didn't have the difficulty of a few months before that, I may not have appreciated it so much when it actually happened. And that can be with a lot of things in life, I think. So, yeah, the community aspect has always been, for me, the most important. And even in the with the competition climbing, my first year competing, like, I, you know, I kind of was just thrown into it, and, you know, I really felt I shouldn't be there. But there was the most amazing group of people I met from all over the world. And these, you know, they were just so welcoming, and somebody else interested in their sport, and it's a new country. And, you know, it was, I think community is at the heart of everything. And for me, my training in Korea, I joined a local Korean climbing gym, and it's that community who, like, I just have to really thank them for everything. So I think community is at the heart of everything. And it is just being involved with other people. And it doesn't really matter about the achievements, what level it is. I think, you know, for me, like, the World Cup success is probably not the thing I'm most proud of in my climb. And it's the small things, you know, it's the small little memories of times that, you know, we were out climbing and it was a hard, long day, and just that kind of camaraderie of the people, and everybody's finding a bit of kind of hardship, but you're always kind of looking out for each other. And and small little achievements are often the ones that are the biggest, in kind of, and I think that's quite, that can be quite common.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of sports people, that, yeah.
Totally. Really random one for you. So, see, after, like, you just described there, I just had such a lovely image in my head, like that long, hard, like, cold day where you're just like putting in serious work, like on the cliff, like climbing away, climbing for hours, and you're like, you know, you're just ready for like a big feed. And like in our context, like, you know, you'd go and you'd absolutely devour like a stew or something. Like, what is like your equivalent over there where it's like, right, we've been out all weekend, like it's been absolutely freezing, we're so ready for some like a big feed. Like, what is it that you're eating?
Do you know what? The Korean food, there's so many different choices, but quite often if you're after something like that, it is a big, massive, hearty stew.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Yeah.
Totally. It is. The food is, or quite often the barbecues are something that people will go for after a big day out in the mountain, but it's always a community kind of dinner. And it's funny, like when you're with Koreans, there's, I guess, the hierarchy in Korea is something that's still very prevalent. You know, that where you come in order is depending on your age.
Oh, and wow.
The oldest people call the shots, and you know, the youngest people they don't really have a choice in anything.
Okay, so it's the very same.
Yeah, if you're going out for dinner, it's the oldest person in the group just decides what what everybody's having.
I love that.
So it's, but it's always, you know, there's, it is the Koreans share food. There's no such thing as everybody having their own dish. It's like big pot or a big grill in the middle of the table. And the food is really good here. That's one thing. There's some things I still can't eat, but most of it is really delicious. I don't know how, like, at the moment, if there's much Korean food back home, but
not a big offering, if I'm honest.
There could be.
There's a few kind of breakout places, but it hasn't really kind of taken hold yet in the same way. I think Japanese is having a bit of a moment, but like explicitly Korean food, I'm not entirely sure. My only exposure to, and this is probably complicated in its own right, is like K-Town in Manhattan, like Little Korea. That was my only real exposure to that sort of cuisine. But I tell a lie, I was in Rwanda for 3 months after school, and one of the guys in the expat community was from Korea. I haven't thought about this in actually 8 years. Wow. And he invited us all over to his house, and he cooked us this like unbelievable Korean feast one night. And I that was my only real exposure to what I can consider, I mean, ingredient dependent, because he was really struggling to get some stuff, of an authentic experience. And it was a lot of like Korean barbecued pork, and there was like there was quite a lot of seaweed sort of things, like things wrapped up in seaweed. That's my only real memories of it, and I just remember being like, whoa, this is very exciting.
Yeah. Oh wow, that's quite an amazing memory to have in Rwanda.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The world is so, it's so strange, and I'd love to talk at some point about like you being this Irish ice queen in Korea. You know, it's so strange that you are like, you're kind of like this multinational in this foreign place, but yet that also leads you to various types of community and stuff. I did want to go back before we kind of go there. You mentioned earlier how like you described yourself. It was a sentence like, yeah, like the me before Korea. And I thought that was like very kind of interesting. I just like made a wee mental note. Like, how do you think you have changed? You know, the Tyrone Emer versus the now like Emer 2.0 that has had all this kind of life experience. Like, how have you changed? Because it's a very, very different culture, even on a like West comparison to East sort of culture. So talk to me a wee bit about that.
Well, you know, in some ways I think I maybe more went back to the way I was when I was very young. And like, when I was growing up in the farm, I just always thought I could do anything. Mm-hmm. And you know, you could, and when you're living in that kind of sheltered kind of life, and you're surrounded by your family, and like, there's not a lot of negativity or people, you know, saying, oh, you can't do this or whatever. Yeah. And I think then, you know, just school and university, and I feel that then that you maybe start doubting yourself.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Well, 100%. That was definitely my experience. I think after I moved to Dublin, I kind of maybe struggled a lot with my own identity, and just, you know, and the course I was studying, you had to have a lot of belief in your own opinions and be able to stand up and design something and then, you know, defend it and
get absolutely crucified with criticism from everybody.
That's it. And like, I definitely, you know, in those days I really, really struggled, and I think that was the thing. I didn't have a lot of belief in what I was saying or what I had designed. And you know, I got through architecture school, but it was a hard time. And I think that was something then when I started climbing, then I was like, oh, maybe like a lot of that kind of self-belief has maybe come back a bit. I think it's something in Korea, it's maybe a little bit just the circumstances when I did start climbing here, I couldn't speak very much Korean, so I couldn't understand, you know, any of the negativity. that is like very true that I had like the captain of my climbing gym and just, you know, the people who had kind of adopted me as their every kind of Korean climbing group kind of maybe had one foreign climber and they kind of were kind of proud of their foreign climber and they'd bring them out and, you know, that was very much
the group
that was
champion. Very much make them fight the other ones. Let's go.
Well, you know, everybody here is wanting to like learn English and just that group of people, they, you know, they would say, oh, just do it. And, you know, they would send me off climbing a route and I would then, you know, I couldn't do it. And I come down and they're like, why couldn't you do it? And they were like, she could do it. Some other, you know, other person would climb the same thing. And, you know, I didn't realize that, you know, they had been climbing much longer and, you know, were already competition climber. And they were like, you know, why can't you do it? And so a lot of the times you're like, and I'm like, why can't I do it? So, whereas if you know the real truth about people's levels, you kind of can put yourself in a place.
Yeah, you were like, oh my word, this person is a beginner like me and look what they can do. That's so embarrassing.
It's exactly what happened in so many cases when I look back now. And it's, yeah, I'd very limited Korean, so I'd be told to do something and, you know, I didn't even have the language to question it, why I was doing it or anything. I just like went ahead and did it. And a lot of the training I did, you know, sometimes I think they were maybe like just kind of pushing me, see how far I would go.
I love that.
But it all paid off in the end, so...
So yeah, great.
Sorry, I went off on a wee bit of a tangent there.
Again, like Matt. I said, it's the tangent show. That's what we're about. I would love to hear like a war story. And specifically, I'd love to hear about the waterfall. Like, tell me about the 20 hours and the waterfall. Give me that.
So, yeah, so I guess I'd started ice climbing and I had always heard of this Tuangsong waterfall, which is, it's the tallest in Asia, and it's like you talk to some people about it and, you know, their eyes light up and they're like, yeah, it's amazing. And then you talk to other people and they've maybe been there once and they're never going back again. You can tell. So I was always kind of intrigued by it, so I had asked the captain of my gym if I could go there, and he said, you know, he's like, maybe. And so that we had been training at this smaller waterfall area, and he said, if you can climb that 60 meters two times consecutively in a row, we'll bring you to Tuangsong. And I thought, so I could do it, and I was like, this is great, you know, I've got this sorted. And so we left anyway. I remember we left like around 8 o'clock in the evening. And we drove, there was a group of maybe six of us, seven of us, and we drove the 3 hours to the other side of Korea. And we started climbing maybe, yeah, it was 4 o'clock in the morning and it was dark. And, you know, I just didn't realize that the approach to the climb itself was like 3 to 4 hours, and it was rustling through deep snow. And I didn't have the fitness for it at all. At that stage, before I even got to the bottom of the climb, my energy levels were really low. And it's kind of funny because you do start to kind of go a little bit crazy in your own mind. And we started the climb anyway, and it was the whole waterfall is 350 meters tall. So we were climbing up in sections, and then we get to another section, and I just remember hanging off the side of it. And when you're climbing in the natural waterfalls, it's almost like a living kind of body or some sort of kind of celestial being, because it's constantly changing, and you can hear like the waterfall is still running in behind the frozen ice.
So such a trip.
So it's just, you know, it's just a kind of really bizarre place. And there was a lot of firsts for me. I'd never seen like ropes completely frozen into the wall before, and I remember hanging off a belay, and there was ice falling, and it was just ice falling from the climbers above us, but they were maybe 50 meters above us, so the ice was falling, and it just it passes, even tiny little bits passes you like bullets.
Crazy.
And I remember just getting hit on the hand by one piece, and there was one, we were, myself and one other guy, we were the last people coming up in the team, and this guy was, I think he was left to mind me because he was very kind of level-headed and calm, and I guess they kind of knew I just wasn't going to be. And I just remember hanging there in this belay ledge, and it was really bizarre thing. Like, he opened his backpack and he took out some ham sandwiches and handed me these ham sandwiches. And he had this tiny little bottle in his backpack with whiskey in it.
Oh, yes.
And he handed me over this, and I was just like, this is so bizarre, because ham sandwiches are not a thing that Koreans would ever carry with them. Yeah, it's so Northern Irish.
Even when you said it, I was like, what is happening here? Is this like a dream sequence?
Do you know, I was like, somebody googled like what to give an Irish person, Irish person in duress. So, climbing that was, the last sequence I remember, I just felt as if I was in some sort of conveyor belt. And, you know, I get up a bit more and I just had no energy left. I didn't have the skill to be where I was at. I didn't have the strength to be where I was at. But I was really lucky that the people who brought me there were, they knew that I was really going to struggle. And they were so patient. They were waiting, you know, they were waiting at the top in freezing conditions for me to finally get my way to the top. And, you know, at that stage, I was pretty hysterical, I think. And I, you know, you're in a situation, and I was always safe. The leader of our group was, like, I was never in a dangerous position. But in some ways, you're so exposed. It's so scary. Like, it's this place, it's very hard to describe, because I've been back there climbing so many times, and it doesn't matter how much training I've done. It's never an easy experience. It's always kind of really difficult and pushing you to your limits. And, you know, I remember getting to the top, and then we rappelled back down. It took like 4 hours to rappel down all the different stages. And, you know, at that stage, it was dark, and we still had to like hike out. And, you know, I just remember being there going, what, like, I want to be home.
Yeah.
I want to be sitting in front of the fireplace. What Literally. Am I doing here? I was like, mommy, I was chatting to my mother. I was like, mommy, I'm coming home and I'm never leaving again. And it was funny then, because I was walking down the trail and I was like, these people, like, what kind of people are they going doing this as a sport? And
yeah, this is what these people do for fun.
And literally 5 minutes later, I turned around and I looked at the waterfall, and it was bathed in moonlight, and it was just it's the most incredible looking structure. Like, having studied architecture, there's nothing I have ever seen that has been made that can ever kind of equate to how extremely beautiful this thing is. And I just, you know, immediately then there's this kind of draw in me, and I was like, within seconds, my mind was like, okay, I'm going to train really hard and come back next year and it'll be easier. Wow. And yeah, it's funny with ice climbing, and I think with climbing in general, like, a lot of the times it's not fun at the time. And I think you just kind of really, a lot of the times you're just kind of, you have to push aside, the coldness. And that day I was quite embarrassed, because I was quite vocal. I cried for a good part of the day, I think. And, you know, coming back down, I was really embarrassed because I thought nobody else is crying. Like, they're like, I'm letting myself down. I'm letting down, like, you know, people from Northern Ireland that, like, I go to Korea and I'm, you know, we're a bit soft or whatever. And I, yeah, so I found out afterwards that, like, it happens most people when they go there for the first time. So it was, but it was, that was a very big turning point for me in terms of kind of training and realizing that being prepared whenever you're going out to the mountains. And it's an unforgettable place. And I still, you know, I still go back there, and I never really take it with a pinch of salt that it's an easy day out or anything. So
yeah.
I think there's these incredible places in the world, and that's for sure one of them for me.
This is a very technical question, and it's probably impossible, but that's okay. We'll give it a go. Like, I want to talk about, like, the dopamine hit. And what I mean by that is, like, there are some things you do in life, let's say, like, I don't know, eating a bar of chocolate or, like, watching a really funny, like, YouTube video, where, like, you'll get the dopamine hit, like, pretty much instantaneously. And then as quickly as it came, it goes, you know, it's very, very kind of short lived. See, when you climb, like, particularly on, like, a tough climb, where does the dopamine come? Like, is it as soon as you finish the climb? Is it like when you're having dinner that night? Or is it like 10 years later now, thinking about that waterfall you climbed and that sense of, like, achievement of the fact that you did it?
Well, that's a very good question. So I think it depends on the type of climb. And for something like that, I think, looking back, you probably enjoy it. You probably, it's when you're down and you're safe. And it's a while after, because you're maybe so exhausted.
Yeah.
That actually for a few days, maybe it's because it's because there was so much adrenaline, because your body was, like, put through so much that for a few days you feel pretty empty. And I think a climb like that, you don't really enjoy it at the time, but the dopamine hit, I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, that's not probably, like, the thing we're talking about here, but I think you get the gist.
Totally. It depends on the type of climbing. And I think that is very similar to competition climbing. That I think it's something you learn maybe more in the years when you start doing competition climbing. Like, I'd never really competed in anything before. And there's that kind of the nervousness and the adrenaline and everything, and trying to keep yourself calm coming up to the competition, because you spend a lot of time in isolation, like at a competition. You can't watch anyone else climbing, because, you know, it's unfair. So everybody's in this tent. And quite often, if the route setters are setting for, like, semi-final or final, you could be in there for 4 or 5 hours.
Oh, and
you just have, you know, you have a chair and you have, like, your equipment, and you can only, like, sharpen your ice axes for so long and, like, your crampons, and you have a lot of time, and, you know, and you can so see the, like, the new people coming in. They're so nervous, and they're, you know, walking about, and they're, like, constantly, like, thinking. And then you see the people who've been competing for a long time, and they're totally chilled out, just reading a book, something completely different. Or, I think for that type of climate, it is, you're putting a lot of nervous energy into it. So the climb itself, I think, in competitions is, when it goes well, it's the most amazing kind of feeling, because it's almost like a flow, and everyone talks about getting into a flow state in sport. Whenever it just feels really effortless, and you're climbing and you're doing everything right, and you feel light and you feel, like, in control. And I think that's what every climber kind of wants. Sometimes you can make it through in a competition round where you've just been fighting the whole way and you just never really got into that flow state. And it's that can be the hardest, you know, just to kind of push yourself through. And then I guess with gym, like gym training, I do the majority of my climbing is just in a small bouldering gym, and training in preparation for the competitions and like maybe outdoor rope areas. So that's a very different style of climbing because it's quite intense. So I think, you know, it's like going for a run. You yeah. probably feel good immediately afterwards.
Yeah, yeah,
you get
yeah.
some food immediately afterwards and you feel, you know, a bit of achievement. So I think it really depends on the type of climbing. And I think that's what's so interesting about the sport is that there's, I think, you know, there's so many aspects of it that there's something for everyone, you know, for people who just like being out and, you know, exposed to the elements, or for people who like being in the gym. I think bouldering is really taken off because people may have no interest in going to the mountains, but it's a social sport where you can meet with your friends and have some fun. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah. And unlike the run, it's like you can uh-huh. go and you can like do a route and then you can come down and have like a chat for like, you know, 3 minutes and then go off and do the next one. You know, it's kind of like that start stop nature. Maybe you're hardcore and you're just like climbing all the time and I'm just like I'm literally just showing up for like, you know, a wee bit of crack. But it's very, very social, and that's kind of what surprised me about climbing, like whenever I first started doing it. Do you train, just a random question, do you train with your headphones on and listen to stuff, or do you always train kind of quiet?
Do you know, I've never really worn headphones. I train with whatever music is on the gym, and yeah. It's funny because the gym I train a lot in is a lot of older members, so there's like
all the bangers are out, are they?
But you know what? Like there's a I think it's like Tuesday evening at 6 o'clock. There's a ballad hour.
Oh, yeah. Come on, that's when you want to be training, let's be honest.
You know, but it's so funny because I've just always been, I've always trained in that gym with that music. So it's just like, it's kind of unusual if somebody comes in and plays something unusual. And like, yeah, sometimes there'd be like, there was an Irish hour.
My goodness.
A few years back in the radio station, and yeah, you get a lot of I remember hearing Pretty Little Girl from Oma.
My goodness.
And played in the radio and
in Korea. So
but I wow. think like when I sometimes I train at some of the other gyms and it's a lot more kind of upbeat and more modern.
Yeah.
And that's really good too for motivating you. I do like a lot of running as well and, you know, cycling, and definitely I'd listen to something a bit motivational there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's for everyone, it's a wee bit different, you know. So I think wearing earphones is kind of an odd, I don't know, I find it really a little bit odd. Maybe my just like orientation gets a wee bit weird or something.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when you're climbing and you kind of want to be like,
when your
hearing.
Ears are like so important, aren't they, like when it comes to balance and stuff. That's probably just bro science that, like coming your way, but there you go.
Well, I think there's definitely belief in it because yeah, there maybe is a reason I haven't climbed with earphones on.
I love that. Changing gears slightly and like starting to move more into kind of like questions that we ask every person, like more like stock style questions. How has your opinion on home changed the longer you've been away from it, you know, after having all this other experience that you now have?
Mm-hmm. I think I've got a lot more homesick for home. I think, you know, in the beginning, coming to Korea was, you know, exciting, and the first few months were hard. And then, you know, I got into routine and I was doing, you know, what I was doing. But my life here was very kind of not a normal life in a lot of ways because I put so much into ice climbing and just the sport and the training that, like, you know, I wasn't there. It took the first few years for sure. I was very social and I had a lot of friends. But then when I got really serious about the competitions, I kind of, you know, from August, my friends who weren't involved in the competitions would always say, like, see you in February or March.
Oh, wow.
That was always the case because, you know, you can't really, if you're, once I started competing seriously, you know, you just want to give it everything. And so, yeah, my life was kind of, yeah, very kind of odd here in a sense, for a while. And I think definitely the last couple of years I've missed home, and Korea's never really going to be home for me. There's so many things I really like about it here. There's, you know, the so many amazing people I've met, but there is no place like home. And I miss people. I miss my family a lot. And I guess being away from home and experiencing different cultures maybe makes you realize what you have at home,
yeah,
as well. So yeah. It's my, I guess I haven't spent that much time at home. I would get home the last couple of years once a year, at the end of the climbing competitions. And I would always just spend the time, you know, just at home in the farm and just spend it with family and that. And so I haven't really, I feel as if like the country could have changed so much that I, you know, I haven't seen. So that's, you know, I feel as if now I'm winding down. I don't know how much longer I'll keep competing in the sport. And I think moving back home is definitely something that I really want to look towards in the next while. So
very cool.
Yeah, it's you really miss home. Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of expats living here from a lot of different countries, and it's that you just don't have that ease of, like, you know, talking to people from Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. Where it's just, there's that deeper understanding, and you don't really have to, they just understand you and what you're saying. And it's just that ease. And yeah, I think especially living in Korea as well, like the pollution here, there's a lot of negative things. It really makes you think of the fresh air at home. Mm. You know, even before the COVID, you'd always kind of check in the morning to see what the air quality index was. And if it's over a certain amount, like, you'd be advised to wear a mask. So yeah, it's, you know, I think we often think faraway fields are greener, but they can be. But I still think there's no place like home.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I am like absolutely in awe about your story. I think, as you said, I don't think we were rolling yet. The fact that you got into this sport at an age that a lot of people start to consider retiring is just incredible. And I think it speaks a lot of the sport itself, but also just like your own journey is just so fascinating in that. And yeah, I've just really enjoyed like just being transported here to like parts of the world and like these scenes that I never expected. Like that, the moon bathed frozen waterfall, I think will be a picture that I keep in my head for a long time. It just has like, it's such like an eerie, like, but like very peaceful sort of image. And I'm just like, wow. And that's why I love having these conversations, because it just takes you to different places and shows you kind of, I don't know, the lives that people live. Emer, if I guess like I'm struggling to think like where to end this, but I'll go for a tried and tested one. If you could go back in time to like an 18-year-old Emer who's, you know, like just like starting to like think about leaving the farm and going to uni and all that sort of stuff, and you had like a couple of minutes of her time, what sort of things would you say to her after experiencing everything that you have?
Oh God. I don't know.
No pressure.
Yeah. Do you know, it's a hard one. I think like, yeah, I think it's very dependent maybe in the timing now. If it had been a couple of years ago and I was talking to her, I probably would have different things to say than now, because I think just like there's been so many amazing things about living here, but then there has been this, like, I don't know if I would, I can't really say this, but if I would recommend her to follow this path either.
Sure.
I think, you know, there's, but that's just maybe like just situational.
Yeah. It's like, and, talk to me in 20 years and I'll be able to fully tell you the real answer. You know what I mean?
You know, yeah. Like, I think like there'd be no point telling her, because like there's things that happen in life. And I think there's like, for me coming to Korea, and for me starting the ice climbing journey, and it was a very, like, the start of my proper training for ice climbing was a very kind of a sad point in my life. It was my father died, and you know, then I was searching for something, and it was the right person in the right place at the right time, and I had just come back to Korea, and I just remember I kind of, for the first while, I was doing this training just to kind of get through every day,
yeah,
and just to kind of deal with the grief and just to be able to sleep at night. And as well as that, I suppose, I think when your parent dies, there is a sense of that this life, this is, you know, one chance. And so I did all that, and, you know, it turned into something else for sure, and like brought me a lot of joy. But then I think one of the things of living away from home, my mother passed away suddenly, and just before the COVID outbreak. And for me, that was just the complete opposite. I just, you know, I questioned everything, what I have been doing, living on the other side of the world for so long. And just, you know, it just all seemed so trivial, the whole sport, everything. And it's taken me, like last year, it was a really hard year. And, you know, I just kept thinking the whole world is having a hard year with just the time that was in it and everything. So, you know, that was a big point as well. I think it's, you know, any person who lives abroad and makes that decision to live away from home, you don't necessarily think at the time that, like, you always think you're going to have more time. And that's, you know, one of the big regrets I have is, I couldn't be home. My mom would ask me every Christmas, are you coming home for Christmas? And she always knew what the answer would be, because it was just a couple of weeks before the competition season would start. And, you know, I always said when I retire, I'll be home every year for Christmas, or I'll be home for good. And, you know, I never thought that would be taken away. And like, it's, you know, at the same time, I suppose she was always supportive of what I did and that. So I think that's, you know, our younger selves, it's nice to look back. Whenever you think you're so, like, maybe naive about the world, and you think you have all the time in the world. So, you know, I don't know, I probably wouldn't tell her anything. I'd find it out for herself.
I think that is the only real answer there, isn't it? Like, and I really appreciate, like, what you've shared, because I'm not sure if we have that conversation enough, where there is, and like, you know this more than anyone, like, there is such an over glamorization of, you know, the exotic adventurous life. And, you know, it's kind of like very romanticized by, like, people who feel like they're stuck, you know, at somewhere like here, you know, they're in Belfast, or, you know, they're in Oma, or they're in Tyrone, or wherever they are. And they're like, oh, you know, look at her away off doing that. And that, isn't that so great? And it's like, so exciting. Like, on the one hand, yeah, it is. On the other hand, it's like, everything comes with a cost. You know, kind of like what you were saying at the start, like, not like there's nothing that's easy in life. And like, it's always just trying to balance, like, what your sacrifices are in any given moment. And It's really interesting that like it's always hard. You just kind of have to decide like how you want that hard to look like almost. Do you know what I mean? It's crazy.
That it's so true. It really is. I think that like we always, you know, we can look at Facebook and social media and stuff and like I get, you know, I've been so lucky with all the experiences that I've had, and but like, you know, you only put on the good pictures, yeah. The happy times. Like I don't, yeah. You know, I don't put on the picture of me sitting in, you know, like my tiny little apartment. And like a lot of the times when you're preparing for competitions, it is no fun really. Absolutely. Because you're restricting what you're eating. You're like, everything is so regimental. It's not really having the crack at all. But it is true. I think that is life, isn't it? It's always mm-hmm. the kind of the perspective you can take off it. And it's I think that's the biggest struggle more than anything, is like always trying to look on the bright side of things. And you know, I guess now I look at my family, you know, my sister at home and friends at home, and I feel they have achieved so much more than me, because they have family and kids, and you know, they have a lot of other things that they've been doing. And that's, you know, that's life, isn't it?
It is. It's the trade-off. And it really is.
Yeah. And we're all in a different path, and you just kind of have to sometimes go with the flow. And it's an interesting journey for sure.
Well, I'm very, very interested to see what happens next. You know, I didn't realize that you were kind of approaching like the next chapter, and whatever that is, I'm very, very curious, and I'm very excited for you of what kind of the next season of life's going to bring for you. And selfishly, there's part of me that's like crossed my fingers that it is in Northern Ireland, but I guess we will watch this space and see.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of for the ice climbing in particular, that's even when I stopped competing, it is my dream to bring the sport back to Northern Ireland. And ice climbing is at the moment is not a Winter Olympic sport, but it is on the list to be included as new Winter Olympic sports, and it has been a demonstration sport. So I think there's no reason why we couldn't have like a full team competing. I think the expertise that I've learned in Korea, we don't need frozen waterfalls on our back door to do the training. And I think, you know, I think it's just a sport that it's fun. And I think I would really love to see, I have been like discussing a lot with Mountaineer in Ireland, and they've kind of supported me as much as they could, but we've always talked about having at least starting workshop at home, and maybe getting some of the younger climbers involved in it. And I guess with me living in Korea, that's always been hard because my time at home has always been very limited. But I would love to bring it back. Like, I think climbing in general is just such an amazing sport. And I'm always trying to get people involved. Sometimes I can't understand, you know, why they don't love it as much as me from the beginning. But, you know, that's different people. Yeah, I would like to give back to the community at home as well. So it's something I'm really hoping in the future that, you know, this just doesn't kind of end with me, and that we can, you know, get more people involved and bring back maybe Olympic medals in the future in ice climbing. That would be amazing.
Incredible. It would be, oh man. It's just like the arc of the story is just so incredible there, you know. So, yeah, literally, like when you do come back, like let me know. And there's a few people I can introduce you to. I'll not name drop anyone on air, but yeah, I think there would be a lot of people that would be interested in getting behind you on that one. But yeah. Honestly, like, thank you so much for your time today and the sacrifices you've even made to have this conversation so late on your time. I really appreciate it, and I have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it, and I wish you every success going forward.
Oh, not at all, Matt. I really, really thank you bringing me on here, and it's been really great to talk about my experiences. And I may have rabbited on a wee bit about things, but it's been an honor for me. I think that, you know, getting recognition at home, back home, is that's the ultimate thing. It doesn't matter what's going on anywhere else. It's like it's home that really matters. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Unbelievable stuff. Look, thank you so much once again for listening. My name is Matthew Thompson, and we're on a mission to share 350 conversations that celebrate Northern Ireland and the incredible people who call it home. Massive thanks once again to NI Connections for making today's episode possible. And like I said at the top of the show, you can find out more about our global diaspora, listen to other conversations in this series, and sign up to their free monthly newsletter by visiting niconnections.com. Other than that, hope you really enjoyed today's episode, and I look forward to catching you again soon.